This is To Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is local author and retired high school teacher Mike Wicker. Mike has written a series of books, starting with the story of a German spy sent to Evansville, Indiana, on a secret mission during World War II. Mike Wicker, welcome to To Main Street.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
Now, the saga of Erica Lehman begins with your book, Invitation to Valhalla.
Right.
Now, before we delve into the psyche of this iconic character, Erica Lehman, codename Lorelei, I like that, let's start with your years as a teacher. Where did you teach and what did you teach?
Well, I taught at Wrights High School here in Evansville, taught English, and I coached football there for about, well, I coached for about 15 years, taught for 10. We moved here from Colorado, my family and my wife and kids and I, in about 1990, so started up at Wrights after that.
Now, these are glory days at Wrights in football?
Yeah, we had some good teams. We never won a state championship while I was there, but I'd already left by the time they won two in about 10 years ago. But so I missed out on that, but we had some good teams.
Do you still follow the Panthers?
Oh, yeah, sure, sure. Go to the games and make a nuisance of myself on the sidelines. You know how that goes.
Well, that's good. That's good. Now, teaching, have you always taught English?
Yes, yes, that's... Well, and I taught some industrial arts, too, at Wrights for about a year. We lost an industrial arts teacher, and so I taught shop classes for a while, which was a lot of fun.
How many years did you teach at Wrights?
10 years.
A lot of your stories revolve around the military, both covert and overt actions. And I understand the military has played an important role in the Wicker family.
Well, yes, it has. We go back a long time, the Wickers and the Gambrels. That's my maternal's grandparents' name. And my dad, Floyd, was the Army Ranger, World War II, and was wounded on Omaha Beach on D-Day, recouped from that back in England, and he went back and rejoined his unit, fought in the Battle of the Bulge and several big major battles during the war. And And then my daughter, Savannah, spent three tours in Iraq, 3 years in Iraq during the Iraqi war, right after 9/11.
What was her role?
She was intelligence analyst.
Really?
Kind of like Erica, that's right.
Oh, so maybe you got some insight from your daughter?
Yeah, sure. I ask her questions and about certain procedures, and she'll tell me, and there's things she won't tell me, too. But.
Right. Now, did your dad tell all stories about the war?
He didn't, not when I was growing up. He was one of those, greatest generation veterans that they went through the Depression as kids, and they fought a world war. And then when that was over, they went to work and had families and didn't talk about it a lot. And finally, when I grew up, when I became an adult, I was very curious about, Dad's background. And, during the war, and I knew he was in the Army, of course. So I'd ask him questions, and he would answer, but he really never volunteered a lot of things.
That's the same with my dad. My dad was in that same generation. He was in the Army during World War II. He arrived on Omaha Beach, I think, day two, I think. And he was in the Battle of the Bulge, but never really talked about that. He just got on with his life after he got out of the service.
That's the way most
raised
of
a family
them,
and worked hard and retired.
Yep, that's the way most of those great, great people did.
Yeah. Now, you have a son, Zach, and he's...
Zach is a Vandenberg County Deputy Sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's on the road. And
well, good for
you. Very proud of him.
Oh, definitely. Now, your dad being an Army Ranger... Now that's one of the tougher jobs in the military.
Yes, yes, it's like about like the Navy SEALs today. As far as back then, they were like the elite troops. The Rangers were in World War II, and they still are today. They're very elite. But
I saw them. I think they have training bases at Fort Polk, Louisiana. I went down there with the Indiana National Guard one time, and they said that's where the Rangers train down there. And, of course, it's a miserable place.
Yeah, sure, sure.
With all kinds of insects and snakes, and it's hot in the summer. Oh, it was dusty and everything else. Now, your dad is an Army Ranger. What was his role in World War II?
Well, he was, his first battle was Omaha Beach. He was a 19-year-old kid, just, a little over a year out of Evansville, in Wrights High School. And he hits Omaha Beach right at the start of, he was one of the first troops to hit the beach, to assault the beach that day. because they sent the Rangers in first, usually, because they were always sent in first before a lot of other troops. And he was wounded right away, as soon as his foot hit the sand.
Really?
He was wounded in the leg with machine gun fire and crawled forward. And he had a Thompson machine gun, and he kept firing as he crawled forward and got to a little bit of protection, and spent the day there, and they got him off the beach that night and took him back to England, where he healed up in a hospital here. Spent his 20th birthday in the hospital healing up from his wound on D-Day.
So he got back into the action.
Yes, he was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and then they sent him back to his unit. He told me a little bit funny story one time. He said he figured his unit would have fought a lot of battles that he'd get out of, and when he went back to France, they'd hold up in Caen for 6 weeks, hadn't done anything, so he didn't get out of anything at all. So, but then they went on from there. You know, they crossed to France and liberated Paris and fought in the Ardennes forest, and he ended up at the end of the war. He was all the way through Germany and in Czechoslovakia. They had fought all the way through Germany, the Rangers. And we're in Czechoslovakia at the end of the war, when the war ended in Europe, May 45.
Did he come across any of these death camps?
He did, but they went through northern Europe, and the people that the Americans liberated Dachau and some of those Bavarian places, and by the time he got through there, they were already liberated.
Now, you served in the military, too.
Yes, I was in the Air Force in the 70s. I had the easy service, though. I never even went overseas. I had nothing like my father or my daughter had, so mm-hmm. I had it pretty easy.
Now, being an English teacher and a lover of literature, was it always your dream to become an author?
No. Well, no, David, I never thought I'd write a book. Never did, ever. And I was a football coach. Football coaches aren't supposed to write books. but I heard the story about the Evansville shipyard spy, and talked to some people, and they said it was a real story. It wasn't just fiction. And so that intrigued me, and I went to work researching what I could here and there. And in the 90s, this was in the early 90s, there were still a lot of people living that had worked at the shipyard and other war industries here in Evansville during the war. You know, now there's almost no one left, but back then there were still quite a few people, and I got a hold of some of those people that knew of this FBI investigation here in Evansville looking for a spy. So I just kind of delved into it for a couple years, and then just started making notes. And I never really had an intention of writing a book, and in fact it took me 6 years once I started writing, and it came about, and so, you know, we went from there.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking to Mike Wicker, local author, retired high school teacher. We're talking about his first book, Invitation to Valhalla, and this is involving this spy, Erica Lehman. So, a little fact and fiction together, it sounds like, in this novel.
Yes, yes.
Evansville plays the big role in it.
Right, right. It was the spy investigation here in Evansville during the war at the shipyard. But yes, I've never claimed it's a history book. There's so many things I had to make up to make a story. Interviews of people I interviewed, you know, 50-year-old memories at that time. You know how that goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can completely disagree with each other, so you had to kind of pick and choose which ones that you thought might be the most truthful or that fit the story better. So, it's a novel.
Well, this Erica Lehman character is very intriguing, and so how did you come up with Erica?
Well, there was that's a kind of a funny story, too, or strange story, I guess. There was a German, the spy Lorelei that worked for the German Abwehr, was a real spy, but nobody knew her real name. And there was a German history professor at Heidelberg University in Germany, of course, that wrote a paper in the 60s, of course it's written in German, that Lorelei was a woman named Erica Lehman, the daughter of Karl Lehman, who worked at the propaganda ministry under Joseph Goebbels. But So I went with that. I went with that name because that's the only research that divulged a name for Lorelei the Spy.
Now, Lorelei, I know it's on the Rhine River. There's a rock.
Yes.
I've been on the Rhine cruise and saw that. And it's kind of there's a lot of myth about it, too, the Lorelei being some kind of a siren.
Yeah.
And then the ships would wreck on the rock and everything.
Right. Her singing would draw the boatmen.
That's right, yeah.
Her singing would draw the boatmen to the rocks where they would perish, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's really cool. Now, also Valhalla. What is Valhalla?
Well, of course, it's the...
this is part of your book, Invitation to Valhalla.
Yes, the Vikings, Valhalla was their heaven. You know, to the Vikings... their heaven was they die. Their biggest wish was they die in battle, bravely in battle. Then they would be taken by the Valkyries to Valhalla, where they would fight all day and then drink all night. That was the German. The Viking. Yeah, the Norse heaven. But Valhalla, the word the Germans used it during the war to signify Germany. And Invitation to Valhalla, the title of the first book, with Invitation to Valhalla, those three words were a code phrase that they would use to send to spies, their spies that are in other countries, summoning them back to Germany. Invitation to Valhalla meaning invitation to come back to Germany, so therefore the title.
Now, on your book covers, I noticed there are different models who portray the iconic character Erika Lehmann.
Yes.
And it's got an interesting story about your models.
Well, yes. Well, the Invitation is, I think, now on its fourth cover. And this latest one has she's a model. Her name is Colette Pfeiffer, and she's from Evansville. She lives in L.A. now. She's an actress and a model in L.A. And so she poses as Erika on the first book cover and the fourth book, Fall from Valhalla. That's the same woman on that cover too.
Now the other ones
are other characters in the book. Like Hope is that's a character named Zana Rogova, and she's portrayed by my daughter Savannah, the Army daughter. That's Savannah on the cover.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
The crazy makeup and stuff. And right.
And now this. Back to Invitation to Valhalla, we're talking about your first book, and the Evansville shipyard plays a role in that. And Erika is quite an athlete, too.
Yes.
She's a swimmer, and she swims across the Ohio River to the shipyard.
Right. Yes. Well, there have been people that have swam the river. That's nothing that's impossible to do, certainly. And but yes, in the book, that's what she does. That's how she gains entrance, because that was the least guarded area of the shipyard, because they figured, well, nobody's going to be coming across the river. There were guards that patrolled up and down the bank, but it wasn't nearly as heavy security as along Ohio Street and, the land places where you could enter.
Now, of course, the Germans had heard about this landing ship tank, and, of course, the Germans were very worried about an invasion. And they wanted to get the information about these blueprints, right?
Right.
And I'm sure that's probably fact, too.
Well, it is fact. The reason that Hitler could not invade England by, land, they could only bomb from the air. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get across the English Channel and get all their heavy equipment over there. They experimented with barges and things like that, put some tanks and heavy trucks on barges, and most of them would swamp in the channel. So Churchill knew that they would need some kind of a craft. The LST was actually Churchill's idea. It was drawn up by an American engineer, but a shipbuilder. But Churchill knew they needed some kind of, early on in the war, that they needed some kind of revolutionary ship to take tanks and heavy equipment across the channel safely, get it there, and be able to, a ship that could, a very unusual ship that could sail the open sea, still land on a beach, beach itself on dry land, and the bow doors, of course, open, and here come the tanks and the other materiel. But so Americans started producing them. There were 17 LST shipyards around the country. Evansville produced the most, 167.
Right. That's right. We're going to delve into the LST 325 history in a moment. We're talking to author Mike Wicker, and we're going to talk more about the LST-325, the World War II ship docked in Evansville, and the journey of that vessel from Greece, and, as we were saying, the importance of the Evansville shipyard in winning the war. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is local author Mike Wicker. And we are both cheerleaders for LST-325, the floating museum docked right here on the Ohio River. And the ship, it has quite a long history. And as we were saying earlier, 167 LSTs were built at the Evansville shipyard during World War II, but LST-325 was actually built someplace else, Mike.
Philadelphia, right. They only built 6 of them there.
Really?
Right.
And there, very few of them have survived over the years.
Yes, yes. There's, well, our LST here in Evansville is actually the only one, David, that's still sails, the only one that's in the original World War II configuration and still sails. So we got something very unique here.
It is unique. Now, I saw the ship in its battered condition after it sailed from Greece. It was actually docked at a scrap yard in Chickasaw, Alabama, which is right outside Mobile. And I heard there's talk about a possible movie about the voyage back to the U.S.?
Yeah, they have talked about that from time to time, and nothing's come of it yet. But, the rumors have been there, so hopefully someday it'll be done. I think it'd be a fun, interesting movie.
Well, the idea was that these old sailors, a lot of them who had served on LSTs
right.
in the war, both the World War II and the Korean War, went to Greece, got it into some kind of condition to get back on the open sea, and sailed it from Greece to the United States, and they had to get special permission, I think, to
It took them a long time. In fact, when they first got over to Crete, the average age of the crew, let me back up a minute, is 72 years old. So these were some older guys and
old salts.
I think they were all former LST crewmen, and during the war, or Korean War, as you mentioned, but. They got over to Crete, which is Greece, an island of Greece, and about 10 LSTs there, the Greek Navy owned, that had been given to them by the United States several years after the war. LST was one of them, 325 was one of them, but when they first got there, there was a LST 547, which was made in Evansville, was in beautiful shape. The best shape of any of them. And that's the one they wanted to bring back, this one that was made in Evansville. And it took them so long to get approval from the United States government to bring the ship over. It took over a year. By the time they got back to Crete, the Navy had stripped the LST, the wires, the electrical wire, everything. It was in just a shell.
That's the one they wanted.
Mm-hmm. But the next best one as far as shape was the 325, which was not great, but it was saleable, and that's the one they brought back.
And I understand, I know I've taken tours of the ship down at the riverfront, that they think it was a spy ship at one time?
Well, it served, yes, it was after the war. It did some time up in the Arctic Ocean and looking for Russian submarines.
Really? So it has quite a history. And, of course, the LST-325, hit the beaches at Normandy.
Yes, it did. Yeah, it was on both Utah and Omaha Beach. Made 44 trips between Normandy and England between D-Day, June 6th, and August of that summer. 44 trips back and forth, take equipment over. Going back, it would take wounded or German prisoners of war. So the ship was always doing something that was never empty.
Now, like you said, the ship now is operational, and it goes on river cruises.
Yes.
Kind of a promotional event every year, or every other couple of years. And you've been on a crew member on the LST.
Yes, yes, several trips. In fact, we went up the east coast of the United States out in the Atlantic Ocean for a month back in 2008. Mm-hmm. We went, sailed, the ship was still in Mobile. Mm-hmm. And we sailed around Florida and up the East Coast, stopped in Arlington on the Potomac for a few days, had welcomed people on board the tour. Then we sailed up to Boston. We're in Boston Harbor right beside Old Ironside, and it's a fun, very interesting trip.
We're talking to local author Mike Wicker, who has written a series of spy thrillers involving the character Erika Lehmann, a German spy who, she was after the shipyard blueprints of the LST-325, and we follow her adventures through a series of books. And Mike, LST-325, we're talking about the ship that's docked here in Evansville. It's become quite a museum, and I keep adding things to it. I know in the belly of the ship they have a certain memorabilia from World War II, and they keep adding things.
Right. Yeah. They get donations quite often from old veterans that figure their grandkids are not going to care about this stuff, and donations mainly. There's old uniforms, there's flags, there's weapons, there's all kinds of stuff. It's very interesting, and for people to see.
And I think it's interesting too that there's a breakfast for veterans on board the ship every year.
Yes, Veterans Day on of course November 11th. It's sponsored by Browning's funeral home. Charlie Browning was an LST crewman during World War II, and his of course Charlie is unfortunately he's gone, but his family still keeps that legacy going, and they fund this breakfast. It's open to any veteran and their families. Cooked in the galley, and so they get to see the ship and be on there again, and it's a lot of fun.
Now, the people who've not been on that ship, they're missing a lot. It has this giant cargo hold where it could carry tanks, large trucks.
It could carry 26 Sherman tanks.
That's amazing.
Right.
That is absolutely amazing. And I know it also would carry some other unusual cargo. I think I was talking to one of the veterans one time, and he said they made a beer run in the South Pacific.
Oh yeah, that was very important. I don't think any LST has ever sailed without a lot of beer on board. We never did on those river cruises.
Well, kind of supplemental fuel there.
Yeah, right.
And the reception that you get when you stop at different cities on these river cruises, I know it's been quite interesting and quite enjoyable to see the people's reaction.
Yes, it is. I haven't been on one in quite a while, but every year they've been to Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, and they've been up the Mississippi River and all over. And the crowds are huge. Lines are huge to tour the ship. And it's wonderful that it still can sail on its own and visit other places so people can see it.
Now, LST-325 also plays a role in the local World War II reenactments
as
well.
Yes. Yeah, it sails up and down the river a little bit, along with some of the LCVPs, the Higgins boats. They lower them off the ship and put some troops in there, and that's what delivers the troops to the riverfront shore, just like it did in Normandy. And it takes part in the Shriner Fest every year.
Now, has it played a role in any movies?
Yes, it has. Our Higgins boats are in the movie, the Clint Eastwood movie, Flags of Our Fathers. That movie was about, the Battle of Iwo Jima and the famous flag rising. But the movie was filmed in Iceland because it has black beaches like Iwo Jima has. And so the production company rented our Higgins boats from us, and they're in the movie.
That's really neat.
Yes.
That's really. Now, you're also active in the Germania Manticore.
Yes.
And for people who don't know what that is, can you explain?
Well, it's a German. Actually, it's Germania Manticore means German men's choir. And, of course, we have a men's choir and a women's choir. But it's a social club, people that are interested in their German heritage, which there are a lot of people around here. But you don't have to be German. The club does a lot of good. It has a college scholarship we give out each year. And, of course, the Volkfest is very famous, one of the big events here in Evansville each year. And it's a fun club.
Now, of course, Evansville has rich German heritage. I mean, we had German language newspapers in Evansville,
yes.
I think, until World War I.
Right, right.
And, of course, then this is when they weren't very popular.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, you also wrote, you know, not all of your books are about Erika Lehmann, the mysterious German spy. You wrote a book called Flowers for Hitler, featuring Ilse Dortch.
Yes, yes. That's a true life biography. Ilse is still alive. She lives down in Mount Vernon.
Indiana.
Yes, yes. And she was born in Munich in 1930 and grew up and was in the Hitler Youth. And by Ilse's own admission, was an enthusiastic member of the Hitler Youth, the BDM, the girls' segment of the Hitler Youth was called the BDM. And went through the war, of course, tough times of the war when they didn't have, you know, hardly any food to eat, or they didn't see soap. Ilse told me they didn't see a bar of soap for 3 years. And she married an American GI in 1947 after the war and ended up in Mount Vernon. And she's still doing well. She's still down there and still a feisty German.
Mm-hmm. Now, the flowers for Hitler, what is that?
Well, that's Ilse presented flowers to Adolf Hitler in a parade when she was a little girl. She was 6 years old. It was in 1936. There's a parade through Munich, and her and her mother and a friend of the family had been taking a walk, and Ilse had just gotten a brand new dirndl. That's the traditional German dress, and she was very proud of it, and her hair was in braids. She looked like the perfect little German girl, and she was picked out by a stormtrooper to give some flowers to Hitler, and the car stopped, and she was basically pushed out in the street with this bouquet of flowers. She didn't really know what was going on. And she walked up, and Hitler bent over and took the flowers and patted her on the head and said that she would grow up to be a fine German woman. And then that was it. The procession started up again, and she walked back to the curb. And, of course, she remembers the thing she says she remembers most about Hitler was his blue eyes. You know, in the black and white film reels, you can't tell, but she says he has the bluest eyes she'd ever seen. It's like they burned into you. And she had dreams of that later on in life, of Hitler and his blue eyes staring through her. Mm. And yes, it was it's quite a story.
And there's a photograph of this, too. I mean, handing the flowers to him?
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. She said there might be a photograph somewhere, but she doesn't know where it is. Mm-hmm. There's lots of photographs of Ilse in that age.
Right.
And we got some of those in the book, mm-hmm. and right before she joined the Hitler Youth and other times. But one of the presentation of her, there were a lot of photos. I'm kind of repeating myself. I'm sorry. But a lot of photos of little girls giving flowers to Hitler in a parade or some kind of when he was inspecting a building or something. And Ilse doesn't know if one of them is her or not.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
She's studied them and tried to find some of them. She thinks look like it might be the one, but she's not sure.
Okay. We're talking to a local author, Mike Wicker, and other books that he's written. And another one that's very fascinating is called Proper Souda.
Proper Souda, yes.
And this is a novel set in Evansville, kind of like in the roaring 20s. And one of the plot twists involves the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes, yes. The Klan, the book is another novel. It's not a biography or anything like Ilse's book is, but the Klan in here in Evansville in the 20s was very powerful. In fact, the Klan in Indiana was started here in Evansville. Our Clavern was Clavern number one in the state of Indiana. Here in Evansville was the headquarters was located down on number one Edgar Street, about where Barry Plastics is now. But yes, the Klan was very powerful here. It influenced who got elected, and I've been told a third of the police department were members of the Klan, and another third were supporters. And so it was, yes, it was quite a force, a political force, and not just here in Evansville, but all through Indiana in the early 20s.
Wow, that's kind of sobering to hear that, definitely.
Right.
Now, coming up, we're going to talk to author Mike Wicker about his latest spy thriller, his love of literature, some of his favorite books and authors, and some advice maybe for aspiring authors. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. My guest is local author Mike Wicker, who has written a series of spy thrillers following the exploits of Erica Lehman. Now, Mike, also one of your novels, we're going to talk about the latest book in a moment. One of your novels is about the Cold War, and is that Operation Shield Maidens?
Yes, yes. Well, in fact, the last 3 books are basically in the Cold War, early Cold War time period, right after the war, 46, 47, 48. But Shield Maidens is, yes, it's almost entirely Cold War orientated.
And, of course, that's prime time for spies.
Right, right.
What fascinates you about the Cold War era?
Well, it's, it was a very, a tense time. And in 47, 48, Russia and Soviet Union had not gotten atomic weapons yet. They had not gotten the bomb. So the United States was by far, the most powerful country on Earth. And so the Russians, of course, were going about. They knew they had to have the bomb, and they were going about whatever they could to try to find out, the secrets behind it. And so that's the early days of the Cold War are very interesting.
Well, of course, now it looks like we're going back to the Cold War. We had this time of detente, and it looks like things were getting better. And now we've got heightening tensions with Russia. So this is probably deja vu again here. Now, in your novel, Fall from Valhalla, you share a quote from Winston Churchill. In wartime, truth is so precious, she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies.
Yes, yes. That's a Churchill quote. Of course, he had many great quotes. And, the fantastic movie that just came out, Gary Oldman won the Oscar for, was a wonderfully historically accurate movie. His war bunkers that were used in the filming of the picture, and very interesting. But yes, Churchill, quite a figure, quite an iconic figure, and a giant, in history, especially in the 20th century.
Well, he foreshadowed, I think, the Cold War. He was very suspicious of Stalin and warned the Allies.
Yeah, he coined the term Iron Curtain. That's that term is Churchill's.
Yeah, he was speaking in college in Missouri, I think he used that.
Yes, yes, yes.
That
yeah,
line.
Yeah, that the Soviets are erecting an Iron Curtain, symbolizing the takeover of, the Slavic countries.
Now, another quote I like is, "The first casualty in any war is the truth." I think that says a lot right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole propaganda machine.
Right. Well, every country does it, including our wonderful country. We had quite a industry during the war of manufacturing lies and things about the enemy and about, how we were doing and things like that. Figures were exaggerated to make it. This happened during the Vietnam War, and anyway, that's just the way countries do it, and even our own.
Now, Goebbels, of course, was the master.
He was the master. Yeah,
he
was the master. Yes, he of course he controlled all the newspapers and radio and everything, public communication device, and so they could they had no problems with investigative reporters, bothering them.
No. So, tell us about your latest novel.
Well, the Search for Valhalla came out about a month ago. It's another Erica Lehman story. It takes place in South America, mainly as a setting, where they've been sent, she and a couple of her other female CIA spies. By now, the CIA has been is up and running, and which took a couple years after the war. But they're sent there to look for Adolf Hitler.
Now, is she working for the U.S. government?
She's working for the CIA now.
Okay,
yes, right.
Switch sides.
Right, right.
So they're looking for these Hitler holdovers.
Yes, in fact, they're looking for Hitler. There was a rumor. Yes, the FBI right after the war, and this is factual, sent a team down to South America because Stalin was positive that Hitler did not die in the bunker. And so several countries tried to investigate, and of course nothing was found. He was never found. So
Erica's alive and well, working for the CIA?
Yes, yes. She's the last couple of books, David. She's with the CIA now. Of course, Germany is defunct, you know, and she lost. She was her character was very loyal during the war, but then at the end when she found out about the horrors of the concentration camps and things like that, that was it for her, and so she's now working for the Americans.
Well, wasn't she also upset about, and she saying the Germans killed her dad?
Yes, yes. Heinrich Himmler ordered her father killed. It was from old grudges that went way back into the 20s.
Well, that's enough to turn you.
Yes,
definitely.
Yes, you bet.
So what does Mike Wicker like to read these days?
Oh, I like to read lots of anything, David. I like, there's an author named Robert Harris that writes the spy novels, World War II. He wrote Enigma, which they made a movie out of, and
right.
Fatherland, another movie. And he's very good, historically accurate. He tries to keep things, accurate as far as history. And so they're fun reads. And LeClaire is another good one, John LeClaire.
Now, when you do your research, I know you've traveled to Europe many times.
Yes.
And I'm sure you've probably been to Normandy and the famous iconic World War II sites. So I'm sure research is very important to you.
Oh, yes. I try to stay historically accurate, and it's a genre called historical fiction, where it's a fictional story or a real story that has fiction within it to bring it together, like Invitation to Valhalla is. And you mentioned going back to Normandy. I've been there several times. One time I took Dad before Dad passed. I took him back there, and the first time he'd ever been back to France, Europe, since he came back after the war, and got him on Normandy Beach, and we found out about the place where he came on shore and was wounded. We think we were in a couple hundred yards of it one way or the other. But anyway, I asked Dad, I said, Dad, how do you feel about being back in France? And he told me, he said, well, last time I was here, they didn't ask me for a passport. So, he still had a sense of humor.
Oh, definitely. Well, I've seen some of the cemeteries in Europe with the U.S. soldiers. There was one outside outside Florence, I think, in Italy that I've seen. It's just beautifully maintained by the Italians,
yeah.
And I'm sure the same thing in France.
Yeah, there's one right off the beach there, Normandy Beach. I mean, it's heart-rendering. I mean, the stones go on forever.
Oh, yeah. So,
we lost a lot of young men there.
So, when you decided to write this first book, what was your writing routine?
Well, I was still back in the. I started Invitation to Valhalla in '94, and I was still coaching and teaching. So my time was limited.
Mm-hmm.
I would write on weekends during the summer and other vacations and things like that. But usually, I start around late morning and write for a few hours into the afternoon each day, maybe to 3 or 4. And that's still my routine. Now I can do it every day because I'm retired now. But so writing is now my full-time job. But I usually write for each day now from about 11 to about 3, 4 o'clock.
So you're still working on something else?
Yeah, we have another one in the works, another Erica book, and it's nice. She seems to be a character that people like to read about, which, again, that surprises me, not being having any training as being a writer. But we'll keep trying to put them out if we can.
Well, how are these book tours that you – I know you do some signings at different bookstores.
Yes, we
that
do.
That has to be very interesting.
Yes, it is. You mean a lot of night – one of the best things, David, about writing all these books is the great people, the very nice people I've got to meet and through them. And so that's one of the biggest rewards.
Well, I'm sure they share stories as well.
Sure,
like, oh, my grandfather did this, and my father did this.
Yeah,
and
back in the in the early days of the books, I get a lot of World War II vets, you know, come to a signing and tell me stories and things like that. Of course, now there's not very many.
No.
You'd have to be about mid-90s at least, and still, you know, if you're a World War II vet. And so there's not very many of those guys still around, or the ladies who worked in the war industries. And unfortunately, most of them, we've lost most of them by now.
I understand your mom was in the war industry.
Yes, she worked at the Evansville shipyard. She was a welder.
Really?
Yeah. And mom and dad didn't meet until after the war, but mm-hmm. they both, of course, played roles in the war.
Now, the shipyard, I know during its heyday, it had like, what was it? 12,000 employees?
19,000.
That's just amazing.
Over 80,000 people worked there during the course of the war. But at the peak of its production, there was 19,000 people working there.
That is incredible.
Yes. I don't know how it could have held that many people. But,
well, I know they worked 24 hours a day, seven days a week.
Right.
And they would turn out one of these ships like everyone. I know it took like a couple of months to get the first one, and then they started doing it like every 10 days.
Yes, yes. Yeah, 1 week they produced two of them. They launched two of them in 1 week, in the summer of 43.
Now, my mom, she worked at Republic Aviation during World War II. She told me she took a bus from Vincennes. They would get the employees up there, and they'd drive down on the bus every morning and go work at the plant, and they'd take them back to Vincennes and work on the P-47s.
Yes, yes. I had an aunt. Well, my mom's sister worked at the Republic Aviation plant.
And there's a great picture that they have of President Roosevelt in a open convertible.
Yes.
Driving through the plant.
Yes. He was here in April of 43, and it was totally unannounced. Nobody knew he was coming. And, in fact, it wasn't in the newspapers until about 3 days after he'd left that he was even here. But yes, of course, you know, he had mobility problems, so he wrote, they put him in the back seat of a convertible, and he drove through the plant, the Whirlpool plant, Republic Aviation back then, and they drove him through there, and there's pictures of him shaking hands mm-hmm. with some of the, riveters and, people like that. So, yes, yes.
Well, we also, of course, Evansville was really a hotbed of activity during World War II. Made tanks here?
They refurbished tanks, yes.
Refurbished tanks.
In a place out where the old North High School on Stringtown is, right behind there. They have it's still there today, the tank track where they would take the tanks on a journey. When the Sherman tanks first got over to Europe, they were very, very, they were death traps. They were very poor tanks compared to the German Tiger tanks and the Panzers in general. So they had to bring them all back and put more armor on them and a bigger cannon. So we did some of that here in Evansville.
Yeah. What a logistics nightmare, bringing these tanks back across the Atlantic.
Yes, yeah, back then,
gosh.
Sure, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. I know what ammunition. I know we made a lot of ammunition to World War II in Evansville.
The 45 caliber bullets, about 98% of them that were made in the United States were made here in Evansville. Of course, that's the shell they use in a Thompson machine gun in the 45, and of course the 45 handgun, and a lot of weapons use that caliber bullet. And actually, there were 200 industries here in Evansville that had wartime contracts. Everything from liners for helmets to camp stoves to just about tents, of course, and just about anything.
Oh, Anchor Industries.
Yes, yes. They had a big wartime contract, made a lot of tents, army tents.
Wow, that's amazing. So you're an author now, and you're cranking out these books, and they're very successful. People enjoy them. What advice do you have for any aspiring authors out there?
Well, I'm so disorganized, David. I don't know if anybody should listen to me, but there's everybody has a different way of doing it. I've talked to other authors, and they write things out by hand first, or they make an outline and a synopsis first, and things like that. I don't do any of that. I never write anything out. It's always on the computer. I just don't see. I mean, writing it and then retyping it seems like double work to me, so I've never done that. So I just write on the computer and when I start I have an idea in my mind of where the story might go, but sometimes it changes, you know, halfway through, and that's happened several times. So you just have to get started. I would tell somebody, you just got to force yourself to get started. That's the hardest part, getting started.
Now, when you look at a sentence, do you parse it, or you just move on to the next sentence?
Well, I could. I don't write the books necessarily in order. Invitation to Valhalla, the first chapter I wrote, ended up being chapter 26. And this last book, the last chapter I wrote was the first chapter. So I don't necessarily write them in order. Several chapters will be in order if there's an ongoing storyline in that, or side plot or something. It'll bring itself together, I would tell somebody. You don't worry about that. It'll bring itself together.
Do you have anybody you collaborate with on your books?
Well, no, of course, with Ilsa on that biography,
right.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time I've ever collaborated with another person on the book is with Ilsa's biography.
Now, these books, they're thrillers, a lot of action there. Sounds like they would make a great movie.
Well, they've been trying to do that for about 10 years, and it hasn't happened yet. Maybe someday. I don't know if I'm going to see it. Maybe my grandkids will see it today, but I don't know. It's taken a long time.
What actress would be a great Erica Lehman? You probably thought about that.
Well, and the producers, the people that bought the option, they've given me so many different over the it changes all the time who they want. You know, I have no say in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And but names mentioned back in the early days were Scarlett Johansson and Charlize Theron, and
yes.
They're in their 40s now, so it's not likely they would play a 25-year-old German spy. But
Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, well, I guess she could. And
if they make it, like, in the next couple of years.
Yeah,
if
it, within, before we're all bones. But,
So you do have an option with the...
Yeah, they every year they...
Who's they?
Well, there's a...
Can started, you say?
Yes, I can. There's okay. A producer in Washington, D.C. named Bonnie Nelson Schwartz had the option for about 10 years. Now there's a group out in L.A. that's headed by two men called... Tony Pulido, who works at Netflix,
mm-hmm.
and Aaron Gusso is a screenwriter. And they have the option now. They've had it for about the past year.
Where does that stand? Do you know if they revisit it every once in a while? Or?
Well, they send me updates.
Oh, they
something,
do? Okay.
Yes, yeah, email. And once in a while I'll talk to them on the phone. But, it's just they're going about shopping around the screenplay, and which I've read, and it's mm-hmm. pretty good. Aaron's screenplay is pretty good. It holds pretty tightly to the book and Invitation to Valhalla, the first one. So maybe something will break someday. It would be fun to watch a movie.
Well, they could combine several of the books into one movie.
They could. In fact, Bonnie, the lady that used to have the option, she wanted to make a miniseries. But who knows?
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what happens.
So what makes a good read, Mike?
Well, the characters. I think, David, the characters are everything. If you can create characters that people care about and are interested in and want to see how they do, that's the key. Then you got something. So it's all about characters. And Eric has been an interesting thing. You know, this is a Nazi who's the protagonist, and which is very unusual and has even got me in a little trouble. But people seem to – I've gotten comments about from people saying – yeah, this woman is a Nazi, so I should hate her, but actually I'm rooting for her. And, of course, she has a change of heart, That's why she redeems herself.
Well, of course. Now, at the end of each of these books, do you kind of leave people hanging there?
I do.
I can imagine.
Yeah, so I give myself some kind of option for a next one. I tie up all the loose ends. I mean, it's not a serial. They're not, mm-hmm. I tie up all the loose ends and give them a... try to give them a satisfactory ending, but I leave myself a little room for something to come along.
Now, do you try to shoot for a certain number of pages in a book?
No, in fact, I used to. And the first three books are very long, too long, in fact. Blood of the Reich and Return to Valhalla, they're about 300,000 words. That's 600 pages. And that's way too long. I think a book that thick, you know, they're 2 inches thick, and I think that intimidates some readers. Mm-hmm. They see that on a bookshelf at right. Barnes & Noble. That's a thick book, and some people don't want to invest that kind of time.
Right.
So the last four or five books have been about 100,000 words, which are about half the thickness. So I think that's a better size.
Well, my guest has been local author Mike Wicker, who has shared his passion with us for history, language, and good old-fashioned storytelling. So, Mike, keep on writing. Even though you are a retired teacher, I know you continue to educate a new generation about our past, which often seems to always foreshadow our future as well. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport. To Main Street on 88.3 WNIN-FM airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11.